under Community Events.
Tune in Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m. for The Underground, hosted by the KBOO Youth Collective. This month's theme is horror. We will be playing stories about Five Nights at Freddy's, working at a haunted house, and the scariest stories that have happened to people. Again, that's The Underground, Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m., KBOO, Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Deacom Street Doorway, a Linton's feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic, open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30 at Northeast Deacom and 8th. The entrance is on 8th, deacomstreetdoorway.com. And here comes the Recovery Zone with Stephanie Potter.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guests today are here to talk about reforming our concepts and treatment of mental illness and shifting away from this notion that mental health is simply a matter of taking psych drugs to balance the chemicals in our neurotransmitters. So I'd like to just start by welcoming everybody here. I have John Keystone of Hearthside Healing. He's a holistic counselor. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you.
And Harriet Cook of Rethinking Psychiatry, and also Marcia Myers, who was a founder of Rethinking Psychiatry. So welcome, all of you. John is a licensed professional counselor and an herbalist with an emphasis on holistic methods to help people who are dealing with mental and emotional distress. And I just have him here because I was reading a lot of stuff on his blog, which is at Hearthside Healing here in Portland. And John, one of the first things on your website is that you write that psychiatry basically took off in the 1950s, which is at the same time that industrial agriculture took off, and you say that that's no coincidence. And I want you to just talk a little about that.
Yeah, basically it's kind of interesting. We, back in around 1950, we started sort of this revolution in how we treat emotional distress. We started using psychiatric drugs. We started with Thorazine, which is this very strong neuroleptic drug for treating people who are in institutions. And from there, we sort of took off. And now one out of five of us take psychiatric medications. One out of 10 of us take antidepressants. So we've had this whole sea change in how we treat distress. And that period, the 1950s, is also when the first book, the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, the DSM, the Bible of Psychiatry, was first written. And it outlined about 100 different disorders back then. Now we're up to over 300 disorders. So we've really decided that we're going to label a lot of folks with these particular disorders and then treat them with psychiatric drugs. What's interesting that happened in the 1950s, too, is that this is when the sort of industrial agriculture revolution took off. We started to do monocropping, and we started to introduce chemical fertilizers, chemical pesticides, mechanized agriculture, and we sort of blanketed the world with this monocrop agriculture and started feeding ourselves with really crappy food that made us feel worse and worse. And from that, feeling worse, we started to medicate ourselves with drugs. So I see that there's a real parallel between industrial agriculture and the rise of psychiatry.
Yeah, that's. I just find that really, really interesting. Do you have any comments on that, Harriet or Marcia?
Well, I just want to say it's not only what we're doing to plants, but what we're doing to animals. And I guess this sort of reinforces my awareness that we are a traumatized society. From the very beginning, we've traumatized the people here, the land, and you're saying in the 50s, we started traumatizing our food and traumatizing the animals that was so much, that are so much a part of our European kind of diet. So it feeds into this very, I call it, this consciousness that we try to oppress and suppress with drugs, that we are in a very traumatized reality right now.
Uh-huh. And I find this all very interesting. And I guess to go from there, okay, and then Robin, what would you like to say?
Harriet, sorry.
God, I'm going to keep doing this.
John brought up, you know, the connection between the land and mental health. Mm-hmm. And the holistic practitioners are more and more studying the connection between the gut and the brain and the microbiome. Yeah. So it's not just the microbiome of the gut, but it's the microbiome of the soil and how that impacts the nutrients that get into the food. And, you know, there's larger implications. I can go very tangential here with climate change and Kristen Olson's book, The Soil Will Save Us.
Yes, I interviewed her. I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, we can get really tangential here, but there's a huge connection between the health of the soil, the health of the human and the gut, and the health of the brain and our behaviors.
Well, right. I think one thing about that, I've been reading a book actually called Gut, and I brought it in, and it's something to do with that we keep thinking that it's brain neurotransmitters that are running our psychology, but apparently we have a whole other brain in our gut, and that's a very influential brain on our emotions and our outlook and our feelings about things. And do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is where a lot of integrative practitioners are moving to and understanding that it's not just about a simple serotonin deficiency model or a dopamine excess model, which is often how people discuss, you know, emotional distress. Oh, you've got a chemical imbalance. Here's this medication that's going to fix that. And it's really, really too simplistic. And there's a move now to looking at these inflammatory things that are happening in the gut. I don't know, Harriet, you had something you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, the inflammation is one piece. There's another way of understanding medicine, which is called functional medicine,
right,
that looks at the root causes of illness rather than how does an illness manifest in the body and what is the bacteria connected to it.
Right.
But it more is looking at, are there nutritional deficiencies?
Right.
Are there toxins? Are there, what's going on psychologically to the person? Because we know from the field of psychoneuroimmunology that what's going on in our psychology affects our immune system, our inflammation. So these are all pieces, you know, significant pieces. So medicine is catching up with that. There's, you know, it's a growing movement of functional medicine. And I wanted to add one other thing related to the DSM.
Yeah.
Is that my understanding is the DSM, from the one class that I remember taking, was never about causes of mental health distress.
Right.
It was only about describing behaviors of distress,
right,
patterns of distress, that so that we could help people. And
right,
and it's been hijacked by the pharmaceutical industry to meet their profit motives gets really confused with what the DSM really was all about. And
yeah, I think originally the DSM was simply describing these constellations of symptoms that people would have. So you know, and so they created these terms that, like schizophrenia. So if you were hearing voices and having distorted perceptions and it was happening over a 6-month period, boom, you have this diagnosis, this label, schizophrenia. But it didn't describe what's really happening and underlying etiology of right. these patterns.
Right.
And so a lot of what happened was exactly as Harriet's saying, is the pharmaceutical companies sort of hijacked the DSM movement and paired drugs with classes of mental illness. So people with psychosis get antipsychotics. People who are bipolar get mood stabilizers. People with depression, antidepressants. And an entire industry, a very lucrative industry, has sprung up.
And another thing about that, to me, is that it's turned into, this is something that lasts the rest of your life.
That it's, yeah, the idea of permanence is also a modern notion. I mean, really traditional and indigenous societies tended to see emotional distress as much more temporary, and with some lifestyle changes, with diet, with some herbs, you could actually shift, and it's that it would be temporary and would not be a lifetime illness. Yeah.
Right.
And
Robbie,
the irony of this for me, one of the biggest, is that the studies that are done by the on the pharmaceutical drugs are generally short-term studies.
Right.
So they take these short-term studies for what for many people is a short-term circumstantial condition, and they turn it into an excuse to keep people on medications for long-term.
For the rest of their lives
and,
in some
and
cases.
And many people in psychiatry are aware of the fact that, you know, at first drugs can be helpful, but
yeah.
then they develop their own, like even antipsychotic-related psychosis. So something that, you know, the right amount, a small amount at the right time when taken long term, and that goes for so many things,
mm-hmm.
you know, becomes the problem.
Right.
Right. And so just to add on to that, yes, the judicious use of medications at the right time can be really helpful for some folks. We acknowledge that, I think. But what we're seeing, part of the problem is not only are these conditions seen as permanent, but the medications themselves lead to really problematic effects when you try to get off of them. And so people certainly coming off of antipsychotics and benzodiazepines often experience tremendous anxiety, sometimes a reoccurrence of psychosis, not due to an illness process, but due to withdrawal effects off of the medications.
Right. I was looking at some stuff online about that, and these chat groups are talking about going, they're getting like zaps in their brain, they're getting
right.
all kinds of shivers, they're getting, I mean, just yeah. weird stuff happening that sounds like going off heroin or something.
Right.
You know?
And that can be on top of the untreated trauma
right.
that may have been behind the initial break in the first place.
Right.
So if the individual has been put on these medications to suppress the symptoms, the anxiety, the depression, the hallucinations, whatever, but there hasn't been with that a working on, well, what triggered this?
Right.
Where was this coming from? When the person's trying to withdraw from the medications, they still have that old unresolved issue inside of them, plus the physiological effects that their brain's gotten used to this major tranquilizer.
Right.
And this is where we're headed, or where we've come from, is this idea that we're not addressing root causes. Oftentimes, when we're in distress, the most common way people deal with that is they go to their doctor, their general practitioner. And this is how a lot of folks get started on medications. And like I said, yes, for some folks, it's really helpful. But we have vastly over-medicated our society.
20% of us are on them now. I mean, that's
right.
like 20 out of 100 people, one out
right.
of 10 of us, or no.
One out of five of us
right,
now taking
right,
something
right.
in distress.
And I wanted to say, because I'm the big picture person, that's my deal, and that is that this is a way of addressing the trauma of the whole society. But the most sensitive, of course, to all of this are children. Oh. And as a teacher for 34 years, I saw how our system works to put children in these boxes where they will be effective and efficient, in the system. And so what I've seen with the system of mental illness rather than mental wellness is that this is just one more aspect of a system that is very subjective and is the social control for the most sensitive, the most aware, and a way of keeping them quiet. Now, maybe this is oversimplifying it, but I don't think so. I think in the big picture, that's what's going on. I also think that this consensus-based reality is losing its grip as far as experts, and that's what you've been talking about. We have been conditioned and taught to look to the experts, but this reality right now, maybe the computer, the women's movement, the listening to each other, cooperation, collaboration, is saying, hey, no, there is no expert except you.
Right.
You are the expert on yourself. And I like to talk about the good news, and I just want to say this just so that it doesn't get left behind. Uh-huh. I got into this 5-6 years ago because of a family member. I went down and talked to Greg Roberts, who is the superintendent of the mental illness hospital that we have at that time. He was
the Oregon State Mental Hospital.
Yes, down in Salem, uh-huh. The Cuckoo's Nest. Uh-huh. And he was brand new at that time. And he listened to me, and I took him Bob Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullet, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Amazing Rise of Mental Illness in America. And he's been there 5 years now, and I just went back down and talked to him. Mm-hmm. And again, through a family member, I have seen amazing changes from 5 years ago, which this family member was totally traumatized by the system. Now the system is working, and it's because of people like John and Harriet and you, my dear, Stephanie, is that they are waking up and they are becoming much more client or client-centered.
Right. Hold that thought. Yeah. Just 1 second, because I want to just put a little blurb in here that you, the listener, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, and this is the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today's guests, Marcia Myers and Harriet Cook of Rethinking Psychiatry and John Keyes of Hearthside Healing are here to just to help us figure out what is really going on with mental illness and how do we need to reform it. And so anyway, and you're also welcome to call in 503-231-8187. But
I just carry on, wanted Marcia. To say that the client-centered idea, or each of us as being an expert on ourselves
and our own body and
yes,
our own mind.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so I've seen that happen. And the other one, I want to just give some kudos. We've also been connected with Central City Concern. And they, too, wow, it's about the person who's coming in and has been traumatized one way or another, or is feeling the trauma, the underlying trauma of just living in this reality.
Right. It's not just homophobia or homelessness. It's just the generalized stress. And then back to what John was saying, the way that we're actually nurturing ourselves, it's all sounds very traumatic if you actually start to look at it. And
so we have to start helping each other and ourselves. Yeah.
Right. But I want to also talk about John had on his website again, great website, John, Edgewalkers, the Gift of Deep Sensitivity. And I wanted to talk about we talk about people being crazy, but I think that there's some notion that maybe these people are actually tuned into something that more of us need to be paying attention to. Could you guys sort of address this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that there's a term that came out of the 90s from the autistic community, and the term is neurodiversity. And that idea is that all of us are not wired the same. Some of us have more, ability to tap into perceptions and experiences and non-consensual reality that is a gift that that is something that should be honored as a gift and not necessarily pathologized or medicalized and treated with meds. And so I
think of Temple Grandin, for instance.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for folks like that, they often get slotted into, you know, being pathologized and taking meds. And I think there's not enough room, there's not enough place for offering different ways of working with those states. Yeah. Harriet?
Yeah. Yeah, a couple things. It's great topic. And one of the things in the DSM that's really important is that in order for people to be diagnosed with the disorder, there has to be a functional problem. So the fact that someone has hallucinations or perceptual differences
right.
isn't enough to have a disorder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if it's interfering with the way that you yeah. interact with people, then it's a different... So I think that maybe within the DSM there's room for this.
Right.
The other thing that I wanted to... point out was a workshop that I went to with Jim Phelps, who's a psychiatrist who works with bipolar 2 disorder individuals. He's been doing that for decades. Fascinating workshop. He talked about genetically how bipolar 2 individuals are different. And they're sensitive, empathetic people. They have a gift for being able to put many different kinds of ideas and to synthesize them into new ideas. These are the creatives. These kinds of individuals, when they're in relatively stable settings, they create all kinds of new whatever.
Right. Artists, writers, whatever.
Scientists.
Awareness is of our possibilities.
Right, yeah. right. They can be engineers. They can be in any field. But when these individuals are subjected to environmental situational stress, and I'm going to use the word we here.
I'm included.
Yeah, we decompensate.
Yes.
We have very strong emotions. It's one right. of the other qualities of individuals with this bipolar 2. I'm going to call it capacity. Again,
right.
it's not a disorder until it's a disorder. And
right.
it's not a disorder in the person until their gifts and the container that the society offers to help take care of people. Everybody's got strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
And, you know, our strong emotions and our empathy, when I walk down the street and I see people on the corner, it affects me. I've got to deal with that before
right.
I can move on with my life.
Right.
And
right.
a lot of these folks like us who tend to be more sensitive or edge walkers, you know, we are living in a society that is trauma filled. And so it's just that much harder to get along in this society because it's so challenging in terms of oppression, financial, you know, poverty, homelessness, lack of adequate, you know, resources in the community, all of these reduce our resiliency. And if
right.
we're already sensitive, then that can tip over, spill over quickly.
And make us dysfunctional.
Yeah,
We have a caller. Chris, would you like to enter in with what you would like to say?
Yes, thank you very much. I've worked with the state and with counties over the last 25 years in the mental health system, and I've noticed a lot of changes. But with the one I'd like to bring up related to what you're discussing is the tendency to have many groups, factions, advocacy groups that want to put in their ideas about what should change. And as a result, what we have are diminished resources within community mental health systems trying to accomplish much more than the expectations that were there many years ago. And yet there is no mechanism to really evaluate what is really working with whom.
Hmm. You go,
yeah, in. Yeah. Thank you, Chris, for bringing up the issue of resources. And sometimes it's when we see two things happening at the same time, like all these groups with all these ideas and diminished resources, it's very easy to try and connect and say, oh, maybe this causes this. I'm going to suggest that those are two separate issues. And I agree with you, Chris, that we need to be evaluating the variety of programs and offerings that we have, because it's evaluation that lets us know, is this particular therapy, this whatever, is this good for just this one individual who's so passionate about it? Or is this good for many people?
Right.
And so that has to be part of it. The decrease in resources, however, I think is a part of the larger widening of income disparities, the whole capitalistic mess and the undoing of the New Deal, which allowed us to have a middle class. So there's deeper political structural issues that I say are the cause for the diminished resources, rather than all these different groups that are alive with different ideas and are coming together at the table, many of them.
Trying to figure this out. And one thing about that, too, I mean, I definitely see that there's less money everywhere. However, we do have the Affordable Care Act. But as John wrote, again, on his website, that there is this fear, in a way, that the Affordable Care Act, which is supposed to be providing more mental health for people, could end up just giving them more drugs. And Is that likely, or are they going to actually get talk therapy and better nutrition and things like that too? Or
and they're not going to get those things unless we continue to speak up. And that's what I want. And I guess I was trying to say that before.
Right.
There is this voice that is rising, and I've heard it in the last, since I've become aware of this whole issue. It's getting louder and louder, and I want to encourage everyone out there to, when I say the good things that are happening, they're happening because of you. They're happening because of us. They're happening because of the Edgewalkers. They're happening because of the children. Thank grace for that. So we have to keep that voice loud. And I do believe in the universal voice. I think this awareness, this holistic idea that we're connected to the earth, to our food, to the plants, and to each other.
And the animals.
It's not rocket science, and it's not new. But we have to keep talking about it, because the system we're in, as Harriet pointed out so well, is not functional in it fragments all of these things, whereas they're all connected. And we're becoming more and more aware. So keep speaking up. It's happening.
Just to add on to that, too, I mean, there's a very interesting article that came out of the New York Times just a few days ago that described these longitudinal studies that show that, you know, it's better to treat people who are having psychosis with talk therapy long term than the high dose, you know, psychiatric neuroleptic drug model, which we've been doing primarily. So, yes, we need to be doing more in our communities. I've worked in a hospital setting. For a psychiatric hospital setting, and it costs $1,000 a day to go there. And you come in off the streets and you've experienced trauma, you may be homeless, you've had a hard life, and you feel depressed. And you come in and you get a night or two there, and it costs thousands of dollars, and you go away with a psychiatric drug. And that's not addressing what we need to do. Going back to Kennedy in the 60s, we need to fund community-based care for people who are in distress much more than just this Band-Aid hospital approach.
Right.
The politics of it are huge. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, John. Because, yeah, you know, you get a prescription, but do you get a place to live?
Right.
Right.
You know, how are you going to address somebody's depression and feeling of isolation and alienation, and there's no place for me when there's no place for them?
Right.
You know, and that's both in living. The affordable housing and problem is huge, and it's also in work. Marcia brought up the issue of the limited scope of acceptable behavior in our society,
right,
and in classrooms.
Yeah.
Well, there's a limited scope of work.
Yeah.
Some people are humans who do things with our hands, and when we do things with our hands and move our bodies, we're happy.
Right. The productivity is getting out of control.
Well, there's so many levels of that, because it's like if machines do it, so those of us who do that kind of work, we're like useless, or we're stuck in jobs where we have to sit, and that makes us crazy. So there's re-unpacking what it means to be human and creating the work for everybody so that we all feel like we belong here. And that's connected to the local economy movement, which is connected to the solutions for climate change. So it's all connected.
Right. And this whole, the word functional is very scary because, but I understand what you meant, Harriet, that these are not disorders till they are disturbing your functioning. But what we call functioning in this very limited reality, and that's where I say back
it's
to
subjective.
The kids, giving them drugs, this whole ADHD and all of these, nothing's a disorder. And then you alluded to, and I just want to sort of put it up again, there are things that we haven't even imagined that we can create as human beings. We're just brilliant with ideas. And we have stifled so much of that by fear. It's about fear. We scare the hell out of kids. We scare the hell out of edge walkers. And so we have to start patting each other on the back and saying, yes, come up with some more ideas.
Help our
so
guts
that
not
what
freak
we
out.
Call functional is an array of wonderful things instead of sitting in front of a computer.
Or a TV set.
Right.
Okay, real quick, I want to just again let people know, and we have a caller on the phone too. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, the Recovery Zone. We're focused on healing our world, and today we're really talking about mental illness and where it needs to go in terms of rethinking in terms of mental health. I have John Keystone of Hearthside Healing, Harriet Cook of Rethinking Psychiatry.
And it's actually Keys, but I have heard Keys all my life. I'm fine with it, but definitely not Keystone.
I do this all the time.
Okay.
It's like part of my psychosis.
And part of your gift. Part of your gift.
And Marcia Myers. And we do have a caller on the phone still, right? Tom, what would you like to ask us, Tom, or talk about? Tom, are you there? Okay, Tom seems to have gone.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Oh, there we are, Tom. Okay, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I didn't hear the last few minutes, but back earlier you were talking about therapies, and I'm about 58, and back in the 60s there was used LSD for therapy, and it got great results until 1966, and they stopped using it. And, of course, the military and Russians experimenting. And I've known to have a higher consciousness. And what I believe the LSD therapy, what it revealed was we're not just the mind and the body, that you can always be trapped and always be traumatized and learn how to deal with your trauma, mind, and medication, but the real energy awareness. Just think of a computer, has a program mind, has a form, a body, and the electricity runs it. But what if the electricity that's timeless is the real consciousness? And we put our energy to our mind and body, and then we can never escape our trauma. But I think the LSD therapy showed that the consciousness is separate from the mind, and the earlier caller talked about amazing things we can do. And I believe in there is a conspiracy. There is a one world power.
I'd love to address that, Tom.
Yeah. I think that's it's actually really interesting these days because there is a resurgence of looking at what are called entheogens or plant hallucinogens, and certainly marijuana for working with people in extreme states. And actually, there's a number of folks, and I'm not promoting this today, but I think it's an interesting avenue of research. There's a lot of returning veterans who have been going down and working with the plant ayahuasca, which is a plant entheogen, and finding amazing results from, that they're not getting a great deal of help from meds and therapy, and they're finding a lot more answers through these ancient traditional ways of working with distress. So I think that's an area for research. I don't think I'll get into marijuana because it's really long.
Well, I've got this article right up on my computer where they're using pot now as a antidote, or using instead of Zoloft or antidepressants, and they're using pot instead of Xanax for anxiety. So it's kind of interesting. And pain meds.
And that there's an array when you say pot.
Yeah. Marijuana.
Yeah, marijuana, pot, whatever. But even within that family, there's an array of various ones. And the good news, again, the good news for Marcia, is that there are more and more studies being done on this in a very conscious, what we call respectable way. John Hopkins, these different universities that have, you know, put out the experts in the past, are now looking at an array of ways to handle things in a much more natural way. So that, too, Stephanie gave us some articles to read or sent them to us, and it was interesting to me to just see these different universities connected with them. So that's part of the good news, too. There are things going on. It's gotten up from the grassroots.
It's bubbling up.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I agree on the value, and not all pot is the same,
right.
And they're parsing out the differences, the CBD and the and the different percentages.
Right.
And the point that I wanted to make, though, is that as we listen to us getting excited about these, the entheogens and the use of marijuana, to remember that we're all unique. So what
right.
is medicine for someone is poison for someone else.
Right.
Whether it's a pharmaceutical agent or whether it's a plant medicine.
Absolutely.
And even for, there's different batches, because when you're working with plant medicine, it comes from someplace, and it doesn't always come from the same place. And the effect that it can have can be wonderful, and it can be devastating. And there are a significant amount of people who, if they use marijuana too much, they become psychotic. They lose their footing. They lose their grip. They lose their initiative. They forget what they're here for. So I think we have to be very conscious about any kind of substance that affects human consciousness.
And we, and especially any kind of blanket approach to all
yes.
of us.
Correct.
And chronicity. One of the things with indigenous people is most of the times these powerful mind-altering substances were not something that they used every day. These
no.
were these were ritual.
Right.
These were, there's a sacredness there.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to get back into the understanding of this sacredness.
Absolutely. And so just to reiterate what Harriet's saying, with marijuana, it really is important to acknowledge that it's not for everyone. And I've seen in my practice people who use it, and it's effective either as a slight, you know, antidepressant or as an antipsychotic to keep them more stable. But I've also seen multiple cases where people have been triggered into psychosis. And so we have to be cautious. We really have to be cautious and not say that it works for everyone.
And it's the balance thing. And nobody right. knows our balance as well as we do. If we
right.
can teach that from the time nursery school, that you are the expert of yourself, and then teach a balanced curriculum of what all these different tools are, because that's one thing we have in this wonderful capitalistic society is many, many tools.
Yeah.
So let's keep them in balance.
Mm. Yeah, and to get back to that, so the main things, like, we need balance, though, in a lot of things. Like, we need balance in our friendships, balance in our diet. I mean, what are some of the, like, as you see, the, like, three or four or five main things to keep us all more healthy or more mentally and balanced?
That's a big question. I mean, you could take it from the macro level, and what we're dealing with is that there's so many systemic issues that impact us that it's hard to just, you know, do a few little tinkering things
okay.
on a small scale.
It's
without,
like, we need to change the society.
Yeah, yeah, we do.
Says.
We do need to address that. But yeah, Harriet, you had a
for me, this one is so important that it's one of the Ten Commandments. It's the balance between work and not work.
Uh-huh.
And the importance of everybody having time off, everybody being able to work in a way that there's time off.
Mm.
And also that there's people taking care of the children. We need balance in our livelihoods when we have families. In other countries, they compensate mothers for the work of motherhood. And imagine that. It's work.
Right.
And it's some of the most important work there is to create a home and a family, but it's one of those things that's devalued in this in this society. I mean, it doesn't have an economic value, and when our survival depends on being part of the economic machine,
to add on to this, these larger, you know, societal issues, I'd go back to my sort of first thing that I was talking about, which is I believe we as a society are deeply malnourished. You know, we're primarily eating a processed food diet with lots of, you know, caffeines and sugars that are really wearing us down. And we're not getting a proper balance of our work life. We're exhausted. Most of us are exhausted and malnourished. And so the revolution, I believe, in mental health care is returning back to looking at how can we nourish ourselves better, not just with food, but with
lifestyle.
How can we be better nourished? So it's really changing dietary habits, looking at how we feed ourselves, how we grow our food is really important. And as an herbalist, I say also augmenting our diet with really nourishing, strengthening herbs.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. And then who are the people around you? Who are the people? Where are you getting your information? And when it's the TV, you know that it's about capitalism. It's about somebody buying and selling. And they're taking your time, your mind. And to me, it's the most disrespectful thing to do with this brilliant part of ourselves. So who are the people around you? That's really an important part of your balance.
Right. And I think there was something a long time ago, and it's probably, sometimes I feel it's less in Portland, but this notion that people are getting more and more atomized and kind of alone in their little nuclear home with their television set.
And their nuclear iPods.
Right.
Or, you know, iPhones.
Right.
You know, everybody's on their little...
Oh, boy.
Walking down the street.
We're connected, but it's all virtual.
Right. You know? And I've experienced this. You go out to dinner with someone and their phone rings and it's like, oh, excuse me. They're... You know, it's like we don't know how to prioritize our time so that we can be with the people and the places that we are with, that presence. So the getting back to attention deficit hyperactivity, we have a society that is teaching us how to be attention deficit beings because that's what's required in the way our world is functioning.
Right, constantly interrupted and constantly moving. Yeah, which, by the way, there is some talk that's going to be happening Psychiatry about this?
Yep, next month. So Rethinking Psychiatry is a grassroots organization. Marcia's here. She is the founder of it. And it was started as in support of Robert Whittaker in his book Anatomy of an Epidemic as an opportunity to really look at the roots of the problem of over-medication and you know, what does it take for true mental health? And we do community meetings monthly on the third Wednesday of the month. The location right now is changing, and I just received notice that in November, the third Wednesday, which is the 18th, we're going to be at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club of Portland, 5250 Northeast Martin Luther King, from 7 to 9. And the talk is Raising Kids with ADHD Without Drugs. We have a website, rethinkingpsychiatry.org, and a couple of us are working on an article right now that should be up in the next week or two on that more holistic understanding of attention deficit, hyperactivity behaviors, and, you know, what are the variety of causes for that and ways that we can deal with that and the problems with drugs and why people use them and blah, blah, blah.
Great.
So you can look for that on our website. And we hope to see you Wednesday, November 18th at the Boys and Girls Club for this month's program.
And then you can check the other months, the third Wednesday, because it is pretty much a monthly meeting. I want to say one of the things that really stands out as a teacher, attention deficit disorder two negatives. You put this on a little child. And so I call it EAA, elevated attention asset. Elevated attention asset. We need to get rid of all this negativity and labeling, or if we're going to label, make it tag, make it EAA, but don't put this on anyone.
It's such an onus. Yeah.
So I'm continually having this argument with my friends at Rethinking Psychiatry, because as a physician and as an individual who has experienced disorders, I do think that there's a role for that word. And I also think that it's overused. Tom Hartman, in his book about ADHD, and he talks about how so many children who are labeled with that disorder are actually children who are made differently. He talked about hunters and gatherers. He was part of that. And how children who have more of the hunter kind of persona, that they need more movement. They need more activity. They don't have a disorder. And I agree totally with that. And from research that's been done, kids that get too much electronic media, who have poor diets and can't sit still, and you change those things, you change some parenting where the child gets some discipline and their behavior changes. Then in that situation, maybe I can say that there was some kind of a disorder, and the child is functionally more
but
optimally.
Who's making those determinations is the scary part.
Well, exactly. And my only concern is imply permanence. And so we say today, I have schizophrenia. Yes. I have bipolar disorder. I am bipolar. And it's an integral to that person, or I am ADHD. And so that idea that, hey, maybe if we change these factors, that there is some different parenting, if we took away the video games and the bad food and, you know, put them in a classroom where their gifts were respected, maybe they wouldn't have a disorder that was a permanent thing. That's right. My piece where the language affects
one
the dialogue.
I'm going to interrupt real quick just to let people know. We also have a caller again on the phone that you're tuned to KBOO Portland, the Recovery Zone. I'm speaking with Marcia Meyer, Harriet Cook, and John Keyes.
Guys, we'll get there. It's okay. All my life. It's fine.
Okay. John Keyes. Anyway, of Hearthside Healing. And we also have Steve on the phone. What would you like to ask, Steve?
Hey, Steve McCray. Hey. I am actually the person who is presenting the November presentation on the 18th. So I was calling in because I wanted to sort of shift the conversation and talk about kids a little bit, but you guys beat me to it.
Okay.
I was really glad to hear Harriet mention the hunter-gatherer work done by Tom Hartman, because I had two of those hunter kids in my family that I had to raise. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, well, you know, they just need a little more discipline. And I don't think that's really quite the case. I think there are kids who really are more difficult to raise because of their personal characteristics. But I very much agree with the idea that this doesn't mean there's something the matter with them. It means that we have to approach them differently.
And Steve, so just also the foster kids that you are involved with.
Yeah. Well, and I'll talk about that in a sec, but I just wanted to emphasize that what I'm going to be talking about in the discussion on the 18th is, first off, what it was like to raise our kids and, you know, the challenges they posed. Also, a lot of the research that I did and my wife over many years, and sort of figuring out what does and doesn't work for these kids, and then finally sort of what we came up with that worked. But I want to stress one thing that I discovered in my research, and that is that as much as they tell you when you take your kid in that, oh my gosh, untreated ADHD creates all these horrible outcomes, like, you know, kids don't, they're more likely to be delinquent, to get pregnant, they're more likely to drop out of school, you know, their academic testing is lower, all this kind of stuff. What's interesting is that I discovered that none of those things are really improved for kids that take stimulants. It doesn't really make any difference in the long run. This has been studied multiple times and in very large cohorts going back to the 60s. So this is not really disputable. Kids don't really improve these big outcome measures by using stimulants. And we're going to talk about some of the other things that we that do make those differences, one of them being alternative schooling, and another being a really different approach to discipline.
What's interesting to me about some of this is that another thing I read is that actually antidepressants themselves, or the psych drugs, 82% seemed, some study I read were 82% were no more effective than placebos or something like that. So, and actually, John, you had something again on, about that on your website. Do you remember that? Or
that? Well, that's definitely true. I just want to honor first, what Steve is saying, that we really need to rethink how we're approaching, quote-unquote ADHD. I want to say, is it almost 10% of kids now have been given this diagnosis? This is a diagnosis that... I'm sorry?
No, of all kids, but it's even more for boys.
Even more for boys, that's right. Shocking amounts. And this is a disorder that really only was created, meaning it was sort of written down, this is a diagnosable disorder, I think in the early 80s with the DSM-3. So it's really new, this idea of, hey, let's put 1 out of 10 kids, or even more, 1 out of 5 boys, on a drug and see what happens. It's an extraordinary experiment, and I think it's really shocking and awful, to be honest.
Yeah.
We need to really relook at those things, and I hope people go to see Steve speak about them.
There is a sense, again, though, that the drugs aren't that effective, and that's what's sort of really interesting to me.
Or they're effective in a negative way. Uh-huh. I think that's a very important aspect of this.
So I attended a family reunion a couple years back where I was speaking what we're all talking about, and two of my cousins, one was a teacher, one was a psychologist, and they were saying, but it works. When these kids, I have a classroom of kids, 30 kids, and I can't get their parents to teach them, to discipline them and to feed them right, and I can't educate and work with all these kids when they're so misbehaving, and when they take their medication, they can focus, and then the whole class works better. They work, and the research shows that short term, they do help to focus at an expense of creativity, and so it's a complicated problem.
Right.
It's not a simple one. And to understand that there are these larger, how can we support families so that they can do the dietary and get the kids active? And how can we support families who are traumatized because the parent has been out of work, and there's stress because they don't, there's hunger and there's in food insecurity and housing insecurity.
Or they both have full-time jobs and the kids are
just
kind of
on their own.
There's a term for what I've been hearing about this way of using medication, essentially as a Band-Aid, that works. It's a Band-Aid, but the term for it is battlefield medicine. We're doing it a lot like battlefield medicine, where we're patching people up. Instead of setting them back to war, we're setting them back to be productive citizens of a capitalistic
to Marsh's
nation,
box workers.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So instead of addressing these much more complex issues, and I get that those families, some of them just don't have the time, the resources, the energy to put into this, or the knowledge. So it becomes very complex of how to work with folks.
Right, definitely.
And how to change the system. And we are doing it, but we have to keep being very intentional and strategic.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what we're all
right. And we do have, again, a phone call. Who would like to talk now? Hello? Oh, we don't know your name.
I have ADD.
Uh-huh.
Don't have the hyperactivity. And I would like to say that the medications that I take, which are stimulants, allow me to interact in this world. And that's an important distinction. I could live without them, but I wouldn't be as functional as I can be with the aid of these medications.
Okay, that's exactly what Harriet was saying.
Yeah. And I'll... There's so many pieces of that. I take something called L-tyrosine, which is a precursor for a neurotransmitter.
Correct.
And for people who have helps me with focus. I can't take it by itself. I have to take it with 5-HTP, which is a precursor for serotonin. I happen to be one of those people who doesn't make enough neurotransmitters.
Well, my issue is that I don't make enough dopamine, or the my dopamine levels are low.
Right.
It shows up as low levels of norepinephrine.
Right.
And so as a senior citizen, I go in and have my blood pressure taken, and I get something like 112 over 66, and they say, oh, isn't that great? And I say, no, this is part of the symptomatology of having low norepinephrine levels. The other thing I want to make a quick comment is, my mental illness is not as difficult for me to handle as the way people treat me because of my mental illness. Mm-hmm. And if you want to address issues, why don't we talk about societal changes and not just put it all on individuals?
Right. Well, I think that's especially Marcia's been talking about this, that the whole society does not actually support our well-being, and including our mental health, and that it's sort of like the Naomi Klein book, you know, with climate change and this changes everything. It's like there's a sense more and more and more of everything needs to change, and I think that's what we've been talking about here.
And the lovely part about this, the good news again, is that there's so much out there that we can choose. I have a friend that I had lunch with, and she said, oh my God, she'd just read Naomi Klein's book, and I just don't know what to do. I said, hey, just pick one thing that you really are interested in and, you know, address it once a week. Just do something, and do something that feeds your soul and your spirit and speaks to you. So it's not like you have to do it all by yourself. We're all doing it together. That's the exciting part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then to just go back, because we're getting really low on our time right now, I just wanted to get back a little bit more to this idea of what John again had on his website, which is this idea of, you had a bunch of different sort of notions: folk counseling, the nourishment model of counseling, which I think we've talked about, the low stim, high support model. Could you just briefly address a little bit what you mean by all these things?
I think mainly, you know, if I could sum up all of that, it's that, you know, we talked in the beginning of this hour of how in the 50s we really had a sea change in how we treated distress. And prior, and certainly if we go back long time, there was these models of approaching distress that were based in nourishment, based in cooking good food, based in using herbs, based in body work, all the traditions from the traditional Greek, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, Tibetan, Yunani Tib, all of them had ways of helping people.
And even rituals and ceremonies.
And indigenous ways of helping people through exactly ritual and ceremony. These are time-honored. We've been doing them for 10,000 or more years, and we've only just suddenly made this switch. And we think of it as like, this is what we do, but it's really new.
I want to add one thing. I attended a Project ABLE recovery program for a week, and I learned quite a bit about the history of psychiatry. And it didn't start in the 1950s,
right.
And it's really ugly. Really, yeah. Really, really ugly.
Yeah.
So that what happened in the 1950s with drugs was actually such an improvement over what was going on before then. And the lobotomies and the incarcerations and the dehumanizing treatment. So I think there's always been this difference between the oppressive use, you know, people in power who want to suppress other people and just work that way, and the people who are the true healers, the ones that nurture, the ones that support, the ones that help in all the ways that John's work is getting out there.
Mm. I love the names that we represent. Hearths. Side healing. It says it all.
It says it all. It's a lovely name. And also Rethinking Psychiatry.
Right.
It says it all. Mm-hmm. So I want to celebrate those two.
Right. Yeah. And any last thoughts then? Because we have like about a minute left now.
Yeah. Well, I just appreciate this, you know, this place to have sort of a forum amongst these wonderful minds and hearts to talk about this. And I think it's a conversation that really needs to continue. And especially with people like that last caller who has been, you know, has received good care from taking a medication. I don't want to dishonor that.
Right.
While also still having a place for discussing how there's problems going on as well.
And the last comment that I'd like to make has to do with something that our group came up with, which is changing the word disorder to challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Because then there's less baggage attached to it, where, as what John was saying, the word disorder has this unspoken connotation that you're going to have this forever.
Permanence.
This is who you are.
Yeah.
Right.
Versus this is something that you're going through.
Right.
That may be challenging.
Right.
And I just want to say it's a joy to be here with these Edgewalkers. And if you're listening to this program, you are an Edgewalker. If you listen to KBOO, so hooray for KBOO.
Okay, and you are tuned to KBOO Portland, your all-volunteer, community, non-corporate radio station. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today's guests have been John Keystone. John? John Kies of Hearthside Healing. Harriet Cook of Rethinking Psychiatry, and Marcia Myers, also Rethinking Psychiatry, talking about reforming our perceptions of mental illness and mental health. I'm Stephanie Potter, and thanks, Tammy, for engineering, and thank you for listening.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house, offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. And we have the KBOO Noon News coming up, followed by jazz. Nick is here. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. It's 12 o'clock.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, October 28, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. An explosion inside a World War II-era tank at a public range in Bend on Tuesday killed two people. There is currently no indication of the cause, but investigation continues